So here we are at the beginning of the second disc.
We're only halfway through.
And I can't believe that some of you are still listening to this. Shouldn't you get some sleep or something and maybe come back tomorrow? This was the cameo scene, wasn't it, where everybody thought it would be fun to dress up as a pirate for the day. We've got Andrew Lesney, our DP, Rick Porius, co-producer, Richard Taylor and Gino from Winter Workshop are there. You don't really need the scene at all, but...
No, not at all.
I think painful's a good and apt description.
Now, I've got to say that I took this arrow and I shot about 6 or 7 takes and I had no padding. Look, I did a big fall onto the deck, a big stunt fall, and I refused to have any knee pads or elbow pads, and I just hit the deck each time. It hurt like hell.
But we didn't even see it.
Well, no. No.
What's the point in suffering for your art if we don't get
to
see it?
Well, you get to hear a loud clunk. The body fall is quite loud. What?
No, that's the moment at which the film passed from being, you know, a fantasy movie into a Monty Python moment.
What the hell? Was that the most motley crew?
There's nothing wrong with Monty Python, though.
Under Jesus.
I just want to say that while this was going on, what were we doing, Fran?
We were trying to
save the film. From the clutches of the pirate.
I don't think I want to.
It's the only way.
This little sequence outside here is my favourite Gollum. I'm most proud of the way that he acts, if you like, if you can call it acting, which it obviously is. The subtleties and beautiful animation. Beautiful animation. And obviously Andy Serkis gave us the reference. It's one of the last Gollum scenes that we did too. It's sort of the culmination of Gollum. It's as good as Gollum ever got. One of the pieces of design that I wanted to do with Shelob's tunnel was to make the ground undulating so that you walk uphill and downhill as you're making your way through the tunnel. Because often in studios, you know, people think about the round caves, but they sort of end up being quite flat on the floor of a studio. So I deliberately wanted to make it, which sort of comes across here, the way that you go around. And the cobwebs are quite difficult. They were made of some weird epoxy rubbery stuff. I like the bony kind of debris on the floor too, little hints and clues.
It's sticky. What is it?
And a lot of this stuff is supposed to be us seeing things before Frodo does, so we start to see skeletons and bits of remains before Frodo realises quite where he is.
See this here. Now, who is that, Pete? Is that Gollum? Is it a Gollum POV or is it a...
I've always imagined it a Shelob POV, in actual fact.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of... It could be anything, of course. But, I remember one of the character things we were worried about with this sequence was just to redeem Frodo in some respects. Because the previous scenes we've seen of him, he's sort of sent Sam home, he's acted like a real bastard, and now we wanted to have suddenly get sympathy back for him. So we just had to sort of fine-tune it.
Yeah, we've always seen Shelob as Tolkien's non-idealised view of womanhood.
Yeah, and we related to her. She's a little bit overweight.
She's got hairy legs.
Cats haven't shaved her legs for a while. Men flee from her. And she's having a bit of trouble squeezing through places she could get through before. So we had some sympathy for her.
And she, you know, has an unappeasable appetite.
A little bit of storytelling that we obviously departing from Tolkien here because this never happened in the books. We didn't want to feel like Sam was coming to the rescue as such because otherwise it would take a lot of the tension away from what was happening to Frodo. If anyone looking at this movie still has doubts that, you know, Shelob should have been at the end of the Two Towers, I just say, well, look at what happens from this point on till the end for Frodo and Sam, and imagine that being their entire story in Return of the King. You actually, if you stop and think about it, you just couldn't do it. You couldn't actually, you'd end up having half a Return of the King in Two Towers if that's what you wanted to do.
So. It was a decision made early and not one that we ever really regretted.
I tried to get the webs to feel like they were... It's like that nightmare where you're trying to run and you're running in some syrup and you can't get away. It's like one of those nightmarish situations where it's just pulling you down and dragging you down. And
it is so creepy.
Yeah. I do think that this this little sequence ended up being a lot of fun to shoot, because it is, it's where you can just, you can have fun as a filmmaker, because you can indulge in all your own fears and all your own anxieties, and I'm terrified of spiders, I hate cobwebs, I hate all that stuff, and I kind of had a lot of fun trying to just make a scene that was scary for me. And we finally get the Galadriel file, the starlight, paid off after setting it up all that time ago. The first image of Shelob I wanted to do was something I'd seen in National Geographic documentaries, which was looking down a little spider hole and just seeing a group of legs bunched in the darkness, sort of just legs. Yeah. I wanted that to be the first image, and then have her sort of coming out of the hole and see her full size. The spider was based on a New Zealand tunnel web spider. There's this horrible spider we have in our gardens in New Zealand. So it's quite small, it's about an inch long, and it's called a tunnel web. And when I was a kid at Pukerua Bay, I always used to find these things in the garden. And I used to be digging around the garden a lot, because I used to dig trenches to do World War I battle films and Super 8.
As you do.
And dig little roads and tunnels for my Matchbox toys and stuff. And these bloody tunnel webs, they live in holes, and I'd always sort of find them, and I'd run screaming away and run for Dad, because he wasn't scared of spiders and he could get rid of them.
But they were
just horrible.
Funnel webs.
No, funnel webs are a different type of spider, but a tunnel web is that little thing with the orange body with the fat
legs. And it's
legs.
Really fat tummy, yeah.
So I talked to Weta about the spider. I said it should look like a tunnel web, and all the Americans that work at Weta obviously didn't know what I was talking about, but Christian Rivers went home and he dug around in his garden and he bought one to work in a glass jar.
Oh, wow.
The following day he got one out of his garden, and he's terrified of spiders too, so it was a really brave thing that Christian did, and we had that at Weta as the model for Shelob.
That's so Tolkien-esque though. Yeah.
Elijah's suspended on bungee cords in this. He's got bungees around his arms and ankles, and I don't even know what the cobwebs were made of, but they're made of the stringy, like almost like hot melt glue. And we used to have sheets of the cobwebs that every time we did a take, we'd have to reapply cobwebs. And all the stretchiness of the cobwebs was there. That was what the stuff was really like. It was super stretchy, a bit like Super Bowl type material. We were always wanting to use Andy Serkis as reference, and so we shot the scene very late. It was almost one of the last scenes that we shot for Return of the King. And then we went to London to do scoring with Howard Shore, and Weta was animating the scene. And so we didn't really have the proper reference we needed from Andy, the close-ups. So we had Andy come to the house in London that we were staying in, and I just got my handycam camera, my video camera, and we videoed Andy lying on the floor in the hallway of this house in London, and videoed his performance of the shots that you're seeing now, these close-ups of Gollum looking up at Frodo, and we then cut those into the Avid, and we sent those back to Weta as the guide for the animators.
I have to destroy Smeagol.
Gollum always knows the ring is going to be destroyed, doesn't he? And he just wants to sort of change his mind. Or does he not realise?
No, not really, not.
No, but we felt that it was important, because we have a lot of...
No, Frodo tells him.
At what point does he tell him?
When they're at the Black Gates, he says...
When they're at the Black Gates,
you
right.
will never have it, and I'm here to destroy it, and blah, blah, you know.
Yeah, but we felt in the movie that having Frodo tell Gollum so early, it sort of just is a bit weird, because Gollum would be so against destroying it.
Mm-hmm.
That Gollum's not sure why they want to go to Mordor, and he's just leading them there. But obviously, just with the hope, at some point he's going to snatch the ring. But he's not entirely sure on why they want to go, and he doesn't ask, or they don't tell him. But there has to be that moment where he realises what Frodo's going to do, and he realises that the ring, the actual existence of the ring, not just for himself, but the existence is in jeopardy, is in danger, because Frodo's now bent on destroying it. I always liked this moment, and we didn't actually have Cate Blanchett with us at the time that we shot Elijah on a forest. That's a real forest in the South Island, and we did it as a pickup. So we used one of our focus pullers, Jack Fitzgerald, to put on Galadriel's costume, and it's her... It's her that's standing here, and this is obviously a shot of Cate Blanchett we did a long time earlier, but we used Jack for the person who actually reaches down and offers her hand. we felt it was important to remind people that Galadriel was entrusting this mission to Frodo, and it was just a way of re-motivating Frodo, wasn't it?
Taking
him from the point of despair into re-energizing him back on his mission again.
Well, actually, he can't even die. He can't even find peace or rest in that. He has to keep going. And she's kind of saying to him, you can't do this, you have to keep going.
Now, this is a nice little scene that I'm really glad is back in the extended cut. It's just a moment that further develops the friendship between Eowyn and Merry and tells us something about what these characters are feeling on the eve of their own battle that they're heading towards.
You are fair and brave and have much to live for.
That's a lovely scene. I really like it.
Yeah.
I like their performances. It's just unfortunate that in terms of the narrative momentum, it sort of slowed things down at a time when we couldn't afford to have it in the theatrical.
No.
It's really nice.
Yeah, it's great. And it was written again to get that bond between her and Merry.
Yeah.
It's also when she says courage, Merry, for our friends before she rides into battle. She's actually referencing this moment.
Frodo.
I like that scene too, because the look in there, what Dominic does with that performance is earns that great line that Théoden says, he's terrified, but he's going into battle nonetheless. And they realise that this little hobbit is absolutely terrified, but that he's going to go and fight anyway. And I think that's what that moment is about as well.
This location's Deer Park Heights, with the foothills of the White Mountains, which we use a lot in the movie. Hopefully it doesn't look like we did, but it was used extensively in Two Towers, obviously, for all the Rohan, the Wag battle and the refugees moving across the mountains. A great location. It's out of Queenstown in New Zealand. So returning to our medieval history, these are now catapults, as opposed to trebuchets. And Jeff Murphy shot a lot of this fireball stuff, didn't he? The fireballs landing in the city?
Yes, it was.
Done on our set.
Is that all CGI there? That's all
CGI. That's all CGI, yeah. Even though I think Minas Tirith itself is CGI. We often shot the miniature of Minas Tirith, and then we projected the miniature footage onto a computer model of the city. So we could get some different angles and slightly different camera moves if we had to. Grond is a big miniature. It was about 8 or 9 foot long. And this set, which was the Court of the Kings, was actually right next to a railway station. It was built basically in the same parking lot as the Osgiliath ruins, and our wet set was built at the Hutt Valley Wingate.
And thus now will I see.
Now we're finally getting to put Faramir's life in jeopardy again. Oh, this is a new shot, the tree. We never quite figured out how to use the tree in the movie, but that shot of the bloom was supposed to be just a clue, wasn't it, that the king was returning, and no matter what Denethor was doing or thought he was doing, there was no way he could stop the inevitability of the fate. Of the fact that Aragorn was now heading back there. It's almost like Aragorn commands the ghost army, he's heading towards Minas Tirith, and so the tree just pops out one little flower. So, and
seems
more
a bit
to come.
Premature to me.
Yeah, well, the tree's...
It's a beautiful moment,
It's an optimistic tree.
It is.
It's thinking, Aragorn's coming, so I might just have one little flower come out. But we never quite figured out. I don't know quite what the rules of the tree are and aren't, and it doesn't really matter, does it?
No, we were making them up to serve our own purposes here.
No long. The Tomb of the Stewards, where Faramir has been carried to, is at the back of Minas Tirith. Alan Lee designed Minas Tirith in such a way that you had to cross this viaduct, this bridge, to go to what was essentially the cemetery, which was on the mountainside at the back of the city. And something just wonderful about the tombs and graveyards. I mean, I remember in the Fellowship of the Ring, we had the dwarf graveyard in Moria, and you have this old tombs. In fact, in Kong, we're planning on having a big graveyard cemetery in Skull Island that we're going to come across. There's something evocative and spooky about this. The wags are quite subtle. You don't really see them that much. They're in a few shots, but the trolls obviously are a bit more noticeable. So these shots were done very quickly. They were done in like the last two, three, 4 weeks of post-production on the film. We had some plates, and some of the plates were not shot with the idea of putting trolls into them, but we managed to squeeze trolls in nonetheless and just make it seem like that all the forces of Mordor were just rampaging into the city, make it as desperate as possible. It was one of those sequences where we didn't have, we didn't really shoot it in a incredibly planned kind of way, but it we managed to take the shots and put it together in a reasonably good sequence. I wanted Shelob to be very old. I wanted her to be ancient. That was the idea, with all the growths and the sort of little tumoury kind of things on her face. Is it just to make her feel like she's been around for God knows how long?
That's my favourite Shelob shot, when she creeps out.
This is one of my favourite shots, the creeping down one. Which was an idea that we had on the set. We were playing around with the wide-angle lens and the camera on a crane, and we were just looking for interesting angles, and we came up with this angle, and then we decided to make it to really feature it as a shot. This is an image that's off one of Alan Lee's paintings, isn't it, on the Two Towers cover, looking up the staircase. But I like the fact that the spider's being really creepy and sneaky and spooky, and this is the one that gets a great gasp. And Elijah was great. They gave him some Alka-Seltzer tablets, which he had in his mouth, which is what creates the foam. So he put two of these big tablets in his mouth and just worked up all the foam and just squeezed out the saliva at the right time. And Frodo's become a digital double here, a CG version of Frodo. Now, the hand that comes in here when Sam appears is actually not Sean Astin's hand. We won't talk about whose hand it is, but I guess if you watch the documentary material, you might find out. This was tough for Sean because, obviously, like any of these monster fights, you know, you're reacting to nothing. And this fight was shot back in principal photography, and we really didn't know what Shelob was going to look like. In fact, Shelob was designed at the very end. I mean, all the way through the shooting, we never had Shelob, even a drawing of Shelob particularly, and we only really worked on her design this last 12 months. Sean was literally just going for it and not having a clue what he was really reacting to or acting against.
But those mandibles were real, weren't they?
No, the mandibles, they were just a couple of black sticks that he grabbed hold of so we could see his hands grabbing something. But they weren't mandibles.
Some of this was later. This was
a couple of these shots were later, yeah. And that's a transfer from a digital double to Sean Astin, where it's a digital double rolling off the back, and then when he lands, we do a little morph into the real actor. I thought the animators did a great job with this after the stabbing. I mean, that looks like a real wounded spider. I mean, not that I've ever seen a spider wounded like that.
Did you have a little Shelob team? Did you have, like, just some people just dedicated to that?
Yeah, I think we had three or four animators who were concentrating on Shelob, but really managed to capture good spider. I just wanted it to feel like a real spider, too, that it wasn't one of those kind of movie robotic things. I wanted it to scuttle and move. It moves fast, it moves slow, it does, you know, it's totally motivated by what she's trying to achieve.
She comes from a long line of spiders for him.
Now, is she related? Shelob's related to the spiders and the Hobbit, is she? Are they all descended off the
Ungoliant.
Same? Ungoliant. Yeah. Who was a Shelob?
Yeah, I don't even know how to say.
Is that in the Silmarillion?
Mm-hmm.
Like a sort of the, that was the,
she was a Maya.
That was a god,
like the Balrog,
a godlike spider, and all these other spiders are sort of descended
she's
off
descendants.
Of her. Yeah, so Shelob's a descendant, and the ones in the Hobbit are descendants.
I believe she's a Maya spirit. Shelob, she's more, you know, of this world.
Frodo! Mr. Frodo!
Elijah had to get wrapped up in this stuff, and he had to spend, like, all day in it. I don't know how he went to the toilet, but he couldn't go to the toilet. Not that I was aware of. He was literally wrapped up in this stuff in the morning and had to just sort of, because it was just, it took so long and we couldn't sort of slip him in and out of it. He was just bundled up like this for a long, long time. Couldn't even scratch his nose. So was this Sean Astin's audition scene, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. We did about 3 scenes for Samwise, and actually Sean struggled. I was a bit dubious, I remember, how he would handle the English stuff. Actually, what was funny was a lot of the English actors who were auditioning found this scene really hard. Sean Astin just nailed it. It was really moving.
Gorbag and Shadrach are played by Peter Tate and Stephen Ewer. Stephen has played orcs before for us. He did a couple of orcs in the Two Towers, and Peter Tate is actually the Corsair captain, the guy sitting on the bridge of the Corsair ship, and he did this other role for us, obviously, in makeup as the Uruk-hai.
This fellow ain't dead.
I'm not dead.
She jabs him with her stinger, and he goes as limp as a boned fish.
Always difficult to make these orcs feel real, but I really like what Stephen does. And this is pretty much the moment that the Two Towers novel actually ends, isn't it? With Frodo being carried away.
Yes.
So if you were being strictly accurate to the book, that would have been the end of the Two Towers.
Yes, Frodo was alive and taken by the enemy.
That's right. Then he'll wish he'd never been born. The choices of Master Samwise.
I remember we had so much footage to have to shoot with David lying on the top of the pyre that we thought to save him having to spend literally days and days just lying on top of a pyre. And of course, there was situations where there were going to be flames as well, that we built a dummy. And a lot of the shots that you're seeing are actually the silicon dummy. They're very big close-ups of his face of the real David Wenham. But anything that's not the big close-up is this incredibly realistic dummy that we just used to save him the trouble of having to lie there.
I love that shot of Billy when he's thrown out.
Yeah, well, that's a little in-camera cheat.
That's really clever.
We had Kieran, our scale double, being thrown out, and we had Billy lying on the floor already in position so he could just pop up at the right time. Actually, it was Fon that got another one of our scale doubles that actually got thrown out.
She always did pip in, didn't she?
Yeah, Fon played Pippin. So all of the shots of Pippin running around in the streets amongst the big people is usually Fon.
Mm.
And Kieran did Frodo pretty much, didn't he? And, yeah. Billy worked very closely with Thon, who was a female, a lady, and Billy really got on well with her and instructed her how to walk like him and perform like him, and she was very, very good. Some of these shots of Gandalf were little pickups that we did, because we had all these wonderful big wide shots, great, you know, vistas, but we didn't really have much coverage of Ian himself, so we set up a little shoot and did some close-ups of him giving orders and instructions. Then we shot some of these big miniature shots, which were again to break the picture open. This little sequence here was one where we added trolls. They were all shots that were done never intending for trolls to be in them, but I gave them to Weta and I said, can you just sneak me in a troll here and there? And you'll see a few shots coming through here where we do... We do just sneak in an occasional CG monster. It was important in the story to try to build the despair, to try to really make it seem like this battle was turning into a defeat. That it was, they were on the back foot, the Gondorians and Gandalf, and that it was fairly hopeless, because it gives a value obviously to the arrival of Theoden.
Well, now we've changed the story, and we've actually changed the story now with the extended cut. The extended cut changes the story.
It does a little bit, yeah.
We always thought Gandalf would react to this showdown with the Witch King, and that the Rohirrim would turn up at that moment.
Well, this is like putting it back to the way it used to be in our script, and we altered it for the theatrical version, but... You know, the confrontation with the Witch King was something... I can't remember why we didn't put it in the theatrical version.
It didn't ever work.
It didn't have as big a value for Theoden arriving, did it?
It's, in the book, it works on a different level. And
there's something sort of disempowering about a character who arrives, threatens to do something, and then flies away again.
Yeah.
Having not actually... Well, he broke Gandalf's staff, but there was just this sense... Made him less frightening and less potent as a character. It was like an event that threatened to happen, but then didn't.
Yeah.
And we really felt it in the pacing of the film.
I mean, we just tried to make it a bit more cinematic and more kind of exciting.
I'm off.
I won't kill you, even though I've disarmed you.
I'll come back to you.
This is probably my favourite scene in this movie. I mean, I like the stuff on Mount Doom with Frodo and Sam, but for some reason this scene, I feel most proud of this scene. It's weird where things happen because, you know, this is obviously in the book and it's something that we were working. I remember when we were working on the script for this, when we were writing the script for Miramax, and it would have been about 1997, I remember on a Sunday afternoon we took our kids out to their grandparents, out to my mother and father's house, and I remember going for a quiet walk in their garden by myself, and this scene, which I guess we must have just been writing it at that time, this scene just played itself out in my head, and I suddenly got the idea for all the different shots and all the angles and all the moments, just sort of the whole scene came together in that garden, and I just hung on to that memory. I didn't write it down, I just had it ingrained in my head. It was about 4 years later that I was actually in Twizel in the South Island shooting the scene, and then another 3 years after I shot it before it was actually released in the movie. But I just have this particular scene has this long gestation. For that reason, I'm very fond of it. It was Bernard's idea, Bernard Hill's idea, who's playing Theoden, to do this rattle along the spears. This was an idea that came late, and it happened virtually, you know, for me, it was something Bernard suggested just before we were due to shoot it. He'd come up with the idea of riding along and dragging the sword along the spears. He thought it was almost like something that Theoden does to raise the morale of his troops. It was a really neat idea. It was hard for Bernard to do because he's left-handed, and yet I wanted him to ride towards the camera. So I remember the look on his face because he'd rehearsed it with the horses holding the sword in his left hand. And I said, well, hang on, Bernard, the camera's here, the horses are here, and if you use your left hand, you're going to have to be riding away from us. So, but I want you riding towards us because that's how it's going to look the best. And so suddenly he had to have the sword in the hand he's not used to holding it in, which really threw him, but he managed to make it work very well. It also shows, I mean, from a purely cinematic point of view, it shows the scale of these horse charges. This is 6,000 horses, which is exactly what Tolkien describes in the book. And interestingly, you know, you see 6,000 horses in those one or two big wide shots that we have here. And interestingly enough, in Napoleonic battles, the Battle of Waterloo, the French heavy cavalry that charged the English were 6,000 horses, exactly the same size. So this is historically what these battles used to be like. I mean, unbelievable seeing 6,000 horses in one spot.
I think this is some of Howard's most beautiful music in the film.
Yeah.
It works so beautifully with the spirit of the charge.
Yeah. The horse charge itself, so I shot all the stuff with Theoden up on the hill, and then from the time the horses start charging, Jeff Murphy did a lot of the shooting of the actual horse charge, which were obviously tracking vehicles with cameras on the back of the vehicles, driving at high speed. We had to prepare a whole big field in Twizel for the horses to gallop on, because one of the most dangerous things in scenes like this, and it's going to sound silly, but you just have to think about it for a moment, are actually rabbit holes. That if you're out in the South Island of New Zealand, there is a plague of rabbits, and there are just rabbit holes everywhere. And you have horses galloping at high speed. They put one horse puts a foot down a rabbit hole. One, you're going to injure that horse terrifically, but if you're in the middle of a charge, you're also going to have all the other horses piling up. And so we had to be incredibly vigilant, and we had to go over and over and over this field with a fine-tooth comb to make sure that all the rabbit holes were filled in. We had to fill them in with dirt and prepare it. And it's dangerous. It's very dangerous to be galloping at high speed like this. Here's John back in his Shakespearean mode. He did very, very well in just managing to get the fine balance, I think, between a fully Shakespearean-sized performance and keeping some element of reality to it. It was a real tough role to play.
That was a one-shot shot, too, because he was pouring oil over a very expensive wig.
Well, that's right, and we didn't have time to have him go back and change and dry his wig and do all that, so we got it in one take, yeah.
I actually think it ruined the wig, too, didn't it?
Oh, it probably did.
Theoden's madness!
And this scene is put together with very careful cutting, that none of this really is happening in quite the way that you see it. But if you look at the shot by shot, we just edit together little tiny pieces because it was dangerous and there was fire and there were scale doubles and there were, you know, there was all sorts of reasons why this was real tough to actually stage. And so we never staged it as a complete sequence. We just did tiny pieces of it and cut them together, which is all that you have to do, obviously. We added a few CG flames in here and there, but most of the flames were actually real.
I always felt that Faramir is the moral compass for his father. His father can look into the eyes of that son and see his own failure, and that for a parent like Denethor, it's like looking into a mirror and receiving back the bad version of yourself.
Yeah.
Shadowflax knocking him back was a split screen where we had the horse rearing up, kicking its hooves with nobody there. And then as a separate pass, we shot the stuntman being jerked back onto the pyre, and we combined the two elements. And this was just another image that I had in my head way back at the very beginning, as I just wanted the flaming Denethor to jump off the prow of the city and plummet. And now, it could never happen in real life, because the distance between where the tomb is and where the prow is so far, he'd have to be running about a mile to get there.
Poetic license.
I just like the image of him plummeting. Mm. It was very hard from a stunt point of view to actually shoot really good fighting between horsemen and orcs, because it's just tough. The horses shy away and, you know, from actually getting close to people, and once you're waving spears and swords around, it's just, it was always just had to do something we had to do with just cutting it very sharp and tight, because none of the actual fighting we filmed was really that great, and we just had to fake it a wee bit. Yeah, this was the scene that I was really looking forward to doing. I got to admit that if there was one visual effects sequence in the entire Lord of the Rings that I've been waiting to do for years and years and years, it was the Mimica, was this scene. Because I, you know, right at the beginning when we first came up with the idea of doing Lord of the Rings, I just was waiting to do this, and I had to wait till the very end because we didn't really put the scene together properly until the beginning of 2003 when we were in our post-production. I wanted the tusks of the Mimica to be more than just sort of tusks. I wanted them to have big, like, maces swinging off chains, and to be, you know, to have all sorts of supplementary weapons on their tusks, like big iron spikes that they've sort of put on there as well.
We were looking at various cuts of that sequence, and in one of the earlier versions, there were so many shots of Mimical taking arrows, the audience sympathy was really with them. I mean, you were really hating the Rohirrim for wounding
the
animals. You really, rear up and they'd wave their paws around, and there was just this sense of
paws. Mimical don't have paws.
No, I know what you mean. We actually didn't use those shots in the extended cut either. There were a few shots that made you look like the Mimical were really distressed. Yeah. And they were like circus elephants. I think it's because we've sort of programmed to be a bit disgusted by the way circus elephants are abused, and they're whipped and they're made to perform these silly tricks and things, and it was feeling a bit like a trained circus elephant in some form of distress, wasn't it? It was pressing those buttons. It was making you feel a bit sorry for them.
There was another shot where an arrow went into eye, which was horrible. But that one didn't survive either.
Well, yeah, I mean, the more abuse we were given to the Mimicals, we had to keep them stomping on horses in order to try to swing the sympathy the other way.
It's a curious sort of exercise in audience sympathy, because when you remove those shots, it was fine.
Mm.
I thought Shane was fantastic.
The driver.
Yeah, the driver.
Shane is one of our stunt boys, and he's been doing stunts with us since the very beginning. This was just about the only time you see him without an orc mask on. He's usually an Uruk-hai or an orc, but he has such a great presence to play the driver, and we thought Shane's actually got the perfect face.
Oh, that's a great pile-up, isn't it, that one?
Yeah.
We literally were just following Miranda's stunt double on a horse, and we put all the battle action in afterwards. We shot a lot of elements of background horses galloping left and right, and we were able to take those and put them into all sorts of different shots and build the battlefield up, add a lot of CG horses, make it seem a lot busy. If you look at these original plates, the documentary on the green screen, that they're so much less spectacular than what you're seeing here. It's It's amazing what you can do. I just get excited by this stuff because it opens up so many possibilities for filmmakers, you know, that anything is possible now. Once the Mummicle hits the ground here, it becomes a huge polystyrene model that Richard Taylor made, which I think if you ask Richard, it's probably about his proudest creation. And the entire experience of doing Lord of the Rings was the full-size Mummicle, which he made for principal photography, and we put it up in Queen Elizabeth Park. And it's enormous. And then there was talk about destroying it, and I said to them, I think we should just store it. And they said, store it for what? You know, we've finished it, we've filmed it. And I said, you never know if we're going to need it again. And then, sure enough, we dragged it out and we put it on our field in the parking lot at Stone Street for doing pickups. And we did a lot of pickups with that Mummicle lying there, didn't we?
Yeah.
The entire Witch King fight was shot in there, and all the stuff with Eowyn fighting. And now we've kept it, because they said after that, I said, we should destroy it now, shouldn't we? And I said, I might want to put it in my garden one day.
But what's the advantage of having something like that as opposed to painting it in later?
Well, it's just you have it there and you're filming it, and it avoids having to edit to every single shot. And it's also something that people can jump around, they can move around, and it becomes just part of a set. You know, otherwise you may as well create everything in a computer, you know, but you don't. You still build rooms. You still build pieces of set for things to happen, and it just became part of the set. Now, this is an important scene that was written as a pickup.
Oh, it's a beautiful piece in the book. It's my favourite part of the book. It's right at the end of The Return of the King, when Tolkien describes what Frodo sees when he's on the boat sailing out. I always was very moved by it, that it was completely pertinent to have it in the story, not to have it just at the end, to give it a value to the characters as the story was unfolding and things were increasingly grim. This scene tells you about Frodo's destiny, so it has a good function in terms of the storytelling, because when Frodo does leave, you have a sense of to where he's going. It's also quite nice to get some relief from the battle and break away from the fighting and come to look at the other side of it.
I know that when we looked at the first edit of Return of the King at the beginning of the year, before we shot any pickups, there was a sense that you last saw Gandalf and Pippin saving Faramir from the funeral pyre, and then you have this whole sequence where the Rohirrim arrive. They basically do what they're doing. Aragorn arrives with the army of the dead, and yet there's no reactions of Gandalf or Pippin. They sort of disappear. Somehow we wanted to see something of their reaction to what was happening. But this is great, because it's not a literal reaction to the events outside the city. It's actually a continuation of what they're experiencing within the city.
It's their darkest hour. It is their darkest hour. We did want that. But we also wanted it to be a scene where Pippin changes at the end of the scene.
Yeah. Miranda was great. She was fighting with that heavy sword and that heavy costume on, and she would literally shoot these takes until she could not stand up anymore, because she's not strong. I mean, she was fit and she was great with the sword, but she's obviously not a tough stunt person. And so we had these long fight routines, and she'd literally get towards the end and collapse. You could almost see Miranda's batteries winding down as her energy was sapping away, swinging and swinging and swinging. And she ended up in tears at the end of some of it. She was just fighting so intensely that she'd bring herself to tears, and we'd stop and we'd reset and she'd go again, and she was just really brave.
She was Castle the Bruiser. She was black and blue. She looked like she'd been beaten to a pulp.
We actually had Miranda doing a fight scene with the Witch King in his old helmet back in the days of the principal photography, and we made that decision to redesign the helmet, and that meant that we had to basically reshoot the fight. And we also changed the weapon too, because we felt that the fight wasn't that interesting.
They had made the mace, and they thought they'd make it 50% bigger, because they knew you'd like it bigger, and then when you saw it, you wanted it 50% bigger again.
Yeah, no, I wanted it huge. I wanted it so big that it looked like it could just take off her head with one hit. A lot of this stuff was just swinging with a stick. He was holding a stick in the chain, and the mace was added in the computer later on. It was always difficult to imagine the relationship between the river and the docks and the city. It was just one of those things that you don't really think about. But obviously it became important to us to have to stage this stuff.
Yeah.
Late as usual.
you know, the orc with the skull on his helm, Joel Tovey plays him. We used to nickname him George, didn't we? And we used to imagine that that was possibly his mother's skull.
That he was a mother's boy, and since her death, he didn't want to be separated.
She went everywhere with him.
So now there's no doubt of who's on these ships based on the footage that's in the extended cut. It's one of the weird things with these extended cuts, isn't it? You sometimes wonder whether you're taking a backward step.
Well, I think we've seen this moment before.
Well, we have. We've seen almost the same image, which is why we took that
which is why,
the version. We saved it for here.
Yeah. Meanwhile, back on Pelennor Field. This is a lot of people's favourite moments in the book and a lot of people's favourite moment in the movie.
Oh, Miranda really pulled off the delivery of the line too. She did. This gets a huge cheer.
I am no man.
Sometimes when you see a movie for the first time with an audience, you really just don't know what's going to happen at certain moments, and we were always worried that we didn't think this was necessarily as powerful as it should be, but the cheering that I heard in the cinema, it makes you feel good. You think, oh, okay, it works. There's a huge sense of relief. 16. Viggo, in this fight scene here, it's the moments pass, but the first orc that Viggo kills is actually his son, Henry. That Henry played a young boy at Helm's Deep 3 or 4 years ago, and here in Pickups, he came back to New Zealand, and he was like this young man.
He's taller than his dad.
Yeah, and so Viggo wanted to use him in the movie, and we stuck him in an orc suit, and he was actually part of the stunt team, and he was the first orc that Aragorn kills on Pelennor Fields. This is a sequence that we obviously didn't use in the theatrical cut, but it was really just to finish Gothmog off, that we felt we'd established this character and we wanted to give him a death and make it meaningful to, you know, Eowyn, who Gothmog's been attacking.
We wanted Aragorn to save someone.
And I like the irony. Through no part of this does he realise it's Eowyn who's actually there. He doesn't know, obviously, that Eowyn's part of the battle. Now, this was a scene that was created just because of the fact that Legolas stunts and Fellowship and Two Towers have gone down so well with audiences, and we actually didn't have anything in Return of the King for him. You know, we'd had the skateboarding down the Helm's Deep steps and the jumping on the horse and the cave troll stuff and Fellowship, and we didn't have anything for Legolas. So seeing how well the other scenes played, I thought, okay, well, we've got to design something for him to do, and the only thing I could think of in terms of where he is in the story was to give him something with a mummicle. And so we invented this whole sequence. The Weta animation department actually did a sort of animatic for me before Orlando arrived in New Zealand of what he could do, so I was able to show Orlando, because most of it's a computer Orlando. There's obviously a few shots of the real Orly and we shot this whole sequence with Orly in one day. We only had a day because he was only in New Zealand. He was shooting Ned Kelly in Australia, I think it was, wasn't it? Or was shooting? Yeah. Or was he about to head off to Troy or somewhere? Yeah. I can't remember. And he was only able to be with us for 3 days. And so we did a drinking competition on one day. We did something else another day, and we had one day to shoot all of this entire sequence with him, which we did by planning it very carefully. And this shot we did deliberately to try to actually explain the sort of dynamics that the ghosts are moving through, killing all the orcs, because you end up with a situation where we've got so many orcs everywhere, all the way through the city, right the way to the very top, that we just had to somehow explain why they suddenly all disappeared, and the fact that the ghosts had gone through and dealt with them all. And this is a sequence that Fran directed. Pretty much, didn't you?
I love the scene.
In fact, you reshot it. We shot it once in the principal photography out at Queen Elizabeth Park, and then we shot it again with revised dialogue, didn't we?
Yeah, we didn't like the shape of the scene the way we had written it. Particularly, it ended actually as it does in the book with him saying, "I wish I could have seen Eomer one last time," and we felt that was so wrong, didn't we?
Yes.
To redo it.
Yes.
But it was also, which I really like, which was a take Fran had on it, which is that
in the very first go-round, she was a lot more weepy, a lot more distraught. But this feels a lot more real.
And we shot it after Bernard Hill had left, because I remember he finished his last day on pickups of Return of the King, and we gave him his farewell, you know, and we presented him a sword, and we gave him the big speech and the party, and then we decided that we wanted to reshoot this after he'd already left. But fortunately, he was on holiday down the South Island and hadn't actually left New Zealand yet. And so we called him up and said, look, we gave you a farewell party the other day, but would you mind coming back for just one more day of shooting? Because we like to do this extra scene.
But and, we knew that they were both up for it. We knew that they were both up for it, and they really... That's why you went there, which I thought was such a cool thing.
It is appropriate because it is Bernard's, it's his last scene that he ever shot for Lord of the Rings.
It was great of them both to come back and do that again. It was really about the bravery of her character, and that she only cries after he's gone. Yeah. She wouldn't do that, yeah. You know, as he was dying, so it didn't feel right. The earlier scene we'd shot, she was quite tearful all the way through, and in a way it sort of wore itself out, didn't it?
And also that, yes, exactly, and that she believes she has saved him. That's what she tried to do. She tried to save him.
Release us.
Finally, we get to say goodbye to the ghosts. This scene was partially written as a way of justifying the obvious question. I mean, if I was an audience member watching this, I'd be saying, well, they've got to go and attack Mordor, right, because they haven't killed Sauron, so why don't they just keep all these ghosts with them, because, like, the ghosts can't be killed, and they can go and they can beat any bad guy in the world if they've got this ghost army. It's invincible. And so we had to actually get rid of the ghosts, and we had to have Gimli ask the audience question, well, hang on, Aragorn, I think these guys are pretty useful. Why don't we just hang on to them? But yeah. Aragorn has made a vow to release them if they help him, and then the king's such a bastard, the king of the dead, such a difficult guy, he doesn't want to do anything for a noble reason, he just wants Aragorn to fulfill his vow, and he sort of puts it on Aragorn to actually do the honourable thing, which Aragorn promised he would, and he does. So we wrote this as a way of justifying what we thought was a tricky little kind of story logic problem.
Well, it's not as tricky as the eagles flying Frodo and the ring to Mount Doom.
The old Middle Earth taxi.
Yeah. As many people have said.
But they would have been... No, but you see, they would have been taken out by the Nazgul, the eagles. They couldn't have done it.
When Frodo decided... Or when they decided at Rivendell to destroy the ring, why they didn't just summon up Gwaihir, the eagle, and fly to Mount Doom and drop it in?
Yeah, but that's because of the Nazgul.
I thought I knew that.
You knew that.
I knew that. So another sequence that was deleted from the theatrical version, the Houses of Healing, which again was only taken out purely for pacing reasons, that we just felt that we were sort of panicking a wee bit, I guess, not really knowing how the film was going to play, and we just wanted to push forward to the climax of the movie on Mount Doom as quickly as we possibly could.
The one thing that these wonderful scenes, these beautiful scenes did, was emotionally drain you, so that but by the time you got to the end, you kind of... were all emotioned out, weren't you? And the weight of the front of the movie started to crush the end.
Well, hopefully most people that are watching this at Cinecut will be watching it over two nights, I would hope, and this is like the second night.
Yeah.
Let's Live a Song.
The music was by Howard and the lyrics by Fran.
The singing by Liv.
And the singing by Liv.
I like it wasn't her character sort of singing to images of herself.
Yes.
Yeah.
I like it because... if you want to see it, Arwen singing to Eowyn, that it's a shared understanding of how painful it can be to love someone.
Yes. I should say it's a really hard song. She's hitting notes there that are really, really difficult. She's got a beautiful voice, Liv, and that was one of the things we wanted to do, was to hear her sing.
The scene in the theatrical version is a daytime scene, and then in the extended cut we've got exactly the same scene. It hasn't changed, but it's now nighttime, which is what you can do with film. You can fiddle with little buttons, turn the knobs, and either make it day or night now with the computer-controlled colour timing. It's a bit less important to know what time of the day it is when you're actually shooting it originally.
It went from day to night, didn't it, during the cutting edit?
Yeah, we couldn't quite figure out where to put it, and it was dependent really on whether the Houses of Healing was in or out, and as to what time of the day it was. It works better as a nighttime scene because it's much more poignant. You can imagine that Pippin has been searching for hours for Merry. He knows he's there and he just can't find him because there's thousands of bodies on the battlefield. Mm-hmm. So it has that poignancy, which is nice.
This was the shaping moment we were aiming for in Pippin's story. This is the moment where we see that Pippin has grown up.
Yeah.
Cirith Ungol was another one of those interesting bits of architecture that... I was always fascinated by the way that Tolkien would describe these particular structures as having been built by the Numenoreans. You know, they were good guy towers. Both Minas Morgul and Cirith Ungol were fortresses that were built by the Gondorians, essentially, in the old days, and they've been taken over by the orcs. So I always liked the idea. That gave us a lot of fun with the design of the places to make it seem like they'd been occupied by orcs who have put some of their own architectural style into the buildings, whacking on bits of iron and rusty spikes on all the parapets.
Along with everything else.
But coming up here is where the shorter orc's wig falls off.
Is it?
Yeah.
Is it for people whose DVD player, they can freeze frame it and it looks
like... Does his wig really fall off?
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Is it
completely
cut?
Bald. Yeah, it's in the cut, yeah.
Whereabouts?
There.
Is it?
Yes, it's in that toss across.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh. Well, people will have to stop listening to the commentary, go back and check it out right now. The fight scene here, we've extended this a little bit. This was trimmed down in a theatrical version, but because it's gratuitous and it's kind of a little bit silly.
How can you say
probably
that?
More than a little bit silly, but I always quite liked it. We had a lot of fun shooting it, just these guys bashing the hell out of each other, so I put a little bit more of it back in the extended version.
And it does happen in the book that they
slaughter
each other.
It's a little bit silly in the book as well. It's slightly unbelievable. And it's very convenient because it means that all the baddies are dead by the time Sam has to go in and find Frodo. Otherwise, it was almost like Tolkien figuring out a way of how on earth do I get Sam into the tower? And he had to invent a rationale which would create the place that, you know, mean the place was empty. But
he did.
Problem with a scene like this is that once you have your bad guys beating the hell out of each other, they stop becoming a potent force.
Well, they never win.
They don't ever win. Like the stormtroopers in Star Wars.
Yeah.
They never hit anything. Thousands of them get killed, and they're sort of threatening, but they never actually deliver the goods.
Mm.
We did have a bit with Sam going past the Watchers, too. The Watchers are those statues at the gate who emit a sort of a weird kind of a psychic barrier that he has to break through, and which I thought about putting in the extended cut, and I ultimately didn't because it does slow the pace down a wee bit. But maybe one day for the 25th anniversary edition we can put that in. We'll sort of keep that one up our sleeve.
Mm.
I always quite like this moment. It's another slightly silly. There's a bit of silliness around Cirith Ungol, but you know, these guys thinking that some huge, big, muscular superhero is coming up the stairs, and then they find out that it's just little Sam. This was just about the only time that Sean ever got to actually do any fighting with a sword. You know, he was in three movies, and he said sword training, and he was so into wanting to be the hero, and like this little fight was about it, and most of it was done by Kieran, little scale double. I mean, Sean got to do swing a sword round about three times in close-ups. The mithril vest shot is another little addition that we did, because obviously we were adding in a subplot that we took out of the theatrical version, which is about the mithril vest. It pays off with the Mouth of Sauron as a character you'll see coming up shortly. Cirith Ungol was a miniature about 12 foot tall. I really like the miniature. We've hung on to that one because it's a beautiful big model. Just have to build a big enough room to put it in. Stephen Ewer is a really great orc. He was one of our favourite orcs, and as I said earlier, he's appeared as several orcs over the trilogy.
And he's from Auckland.
He's from Auckland. I remember on this particular day, we were still in principal photography, almost 2 years before the film was going to come out, and Empire magazine had just put a picture of Frodo on the front cover, and it was the first time Lord of the Rings had ever had a cover photo on any magazine. This was the day we were shooting the scene, and everyone crowded around, and we were so excited that there was an image from the movie that we were still in the middle of shooting had actually started to pop up on a magazine cover. I mean, it was sort of really kind of those things give you a bit of a morale boost, especially when you're a year into shooting a difficult movie. In the book, Sam puts the ring on, doesn't he, at one stage, just as earlier than this, which is something we avoided there, didn't we, in the
Yeah, it was a difficult moment here, and we were, actually this thought was very late in coming to us and how to shape the scene, wasn't it? And in the end, it was a bit of a salvage in ADR. But we at this stage, we were playing Frodo. First off, we were playing Frodo's relief and intense need, almost a junkie's need, to get the ring back. But we pulled back on that because we also realised the scene needed to show actually the opposite. It needed to show that Sam could so easily and so quickly go there.
And that by taking it back, Frodo was helping him.
Yeah.
So rather than Frodo being just a junkie snatching it back, he was actually doing it to save Sam and to help Sam.
We'd seen the junkie.
It gave Frodo a heroic kind of moment. And that was only done with the way that we cut it together. Like, it wasn't shot that way.
No.
But we just kept cutting back to more shots of Sam waiting, which were from all different takes. Because he wasn't waiting for so long in the original take, but we took a bit of waiting from take two, a bit of waiting from take three, a bit of waiting from take four, stitched them all together so that we were able to create this feeling that he wasn't handing the ring over. Because in the original performance, he just says, give me the ring, and Sam just hands it to him. It was like there was no tension at all in it.
It was, and the hesitation was actually concern at Frodo's state, not actual his own desire to keep the ring, which actually you managed to construct really well there. So it was a good save, because originally I think it was one of those things where we actually realised we'd played the junkie beat through in Two Towers, hadn't we? By the time we got to the Two Towers pickups, we'd done that, and at this stage Frodo's fully aware of the evil of the ring, and he also knows it's going to kill Sam.
It's also important for Frodo to show some sort of depth of understanding, because he turned away from Sam when he should not have, but has learnt from that and knows what Sam must now turn away from.
Yes, he does. There's only one way forward now, and that's Frodo.
It's a redeeming moment for him.
It is. Yeah. I wish we'd had that thought, though, because I think we could have written it better.
I know, we could have shot it better, too.
Yeah.
But we did okay in the end.
We got through it.
This was the last day of shooting, wasn't it?
Yeah.
This was the last day of shooting. This was done in the morning on our very last day of principal photography.
Yeah,
this,
and your very last thing in the afternoon was him putting on the coat, wasn't it?
The saw, which I never put in the movie. Yeah, the last thing that I shot in the movie, it did never appear. It doesn't appear in the extended cut either. This sequence replaces the one in the tent, because that was another thing that was in the book that didn't quite work, we felt, in the film, is that we're establishing, you know, we've spent so long with Aragorn making his way to Minas Tirith, that in the book, of course, he gets there and he says, well, I can't enter the city because I'm not king yet, is that right?
He wants people to ask him to live
outside in a tent, and it all seemed too complicated and too difficult for us to get into in the film. So this council of war happens in the book, but it happens on a tent on the remains of the battlefield.
We can give him that. Prince Imrahil, we all love and adore, and the ride of the Knights of Dol Amroth is a great moment in the book, but we just could not bring a new character in at this moment into the story.
It could have been a cameo for Arnold. Arnold's the sort of guy, Arnold Schwarzenegger. I am Prince Imrahil of Dol Amroth. I've come to help you with my knights.
What are you doing?
Wrong colour.
This is what we have to deal with.
I am Prince Imrahil of Dol Amroth. He's got a great name. It's a shame. That was one of the cool things in the book, is that a few people turn up from different outlying counties, don't they, to come to Minas Tirith to help in the battle and to bolster up the armies. And that was in one of our earlier scripts. Prince Imrahil was in our Miramax draft, if I remember rightly. He was there for a while. He made his appearance.
Yep.
This was a scene that we didn't use in the movie. It's kind of cool. We just liked the idea because, of course, we were in our time-crunching mode. We thought it was a great cut to go from Gimli saying his little line about what are we waiting for, which was a John Rhys-Davies ad-lib, and then cut straight to Viggo with the crown on his chest marching out to war. And that was just a real tempting jump cut to make that pushed the movie along and got you really going. But this is how we originally conceived the sequence, which was to be challenging Sauron, which is obviously, it's more relevant to some degree in the fact that when we shot this, we had already filmed Aragorn and Sauron actually fighting outside the Black Gate, so this was the personal challenge that was going to bring Sauron to the gate. And it still works in the context of the film, because because he's basically challenging Sauron's armies to come out to meet them, which is fine.
And there's the dream.
Yeah. So it's there. It gives it a different momentum to this part of the film now, and a different motivation actually for Sauron. And it's good to have this stuff back in too. It's one of those difficult situations where you're taking two characters and having them fall in love very quickly. And we did shoot these scenes, but I guess we just decided in the theatrical cut of we had to just stick with our main central characters, which at this point in time were really Aragorn and his gang and Frodo and Sam, and we had to just exclude other plot lines because we felt we wanted to concentrate on tightening up the climax. But this is nice, and this does certainly earn you the moment of them being together at the coronation.
It is in the book that their hands meet.
I think it's fantastic. I think it's really great that Eowyn and Faramir, who are two troubled,
pretty damaged
characters, get together, and that's great. And that's we never really were able to celebrate that in the theatrical version, but it has this poignancy is here.
I like that you can feel that the death of his father has lifted something off him. He's kind of more fragile.
Yeah.
They're moving off. You see, Mr. Farrell, some luck at last.
This sequence, it's one of my favourite sequences. Not that it's, amazing, but I just love the idea of these orcs and Frodo and Sam being caught out. And I love it in the book, and so I enjoyed shooting it, and I was quite sad to actually see it leave the theatrical version. Again, it was just a pacing thing. But I know that there was a lot of people that I think quite rightly commented in the reviews and things that Frodo and Sam sort of reach Mordor and appear to go quite unmolested, towards the volcano in the theatrical version. So this does certainly make it seem a lot harder for them to actually get there, which is great. This was filmed on a real volcano, Ruapehu, in the middle of the North Island of New Zealand. And it was one of those great days. We shot it over, I think, a couple of days, and it was fun. We had the orcs are the New Zealand Army in these scenes. They're all soldiers from a nearby army camp because this area of New Zealand is a very military sort of, it's a training zone for the army. So we were able to pull in a bunch of soldiers and put them in the orc gear.
Another thought that was late in coming to us was the 10,000 orcs now lie between Frodo and Sam. Remember the emptying of the lands, giving it that physical thing about why the orcs were on the move, tying it into Frodo and Sam, suddenly stumbling across these orcs who are on their way to the front. We know exactly why
they... It's also got great irony too, because Aragorn's marching to the gates to try to draw the orcs away from Frodo and Sam, and here they are, they're actually in the army marching towards Aragorn, which I kind of, I think, is a neat little twist.
Inspection!
Sam, help me.
This is one of my favourite prosthetics. This guy here, who is a guy called Phil Greave, who's played another two or three orcs for us in other scenes in Two Towers. He was an orc, and this makeup just works so well. It's like some prosthetic makeup looks a bit silly and cheesy, and other makeup just seems to fit. And this one is great. I love his white eye and his eaten away nose. He's had like some moths or some insects have had a bit of a nibble at his nose. Rotted away. This is potentially a bit confusing. It was quite hard to sort of edit this to try to make sense because it was quite busy. They escape in a different way in the book, don't they? Something to do with a bridge. Don't they end up hanging under a bridge
under
or something?
The
movie is so vividly etched into your mind that I get to the point where I can't remember the differences between the book and the film.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember if something was in the book or if it was an early idea for a scene that we dropped.
Mm.
My memory is just so muddy about all this stuff because I haven't obviously picked up the book and actually read the book for years. I read little bits and pieces of it.
We were like continually reading it, but
but not reading it. Not reading it. You're just reading sections of it. And then you're putting it down, and then you're reading a completely different section, and you lose the experience of the book as a whole, and I now, my mind is so muddled up as to what, which is what.
I know.
This was a real location. It was called the Boulder Field, which is, it's like a field of large rocks that have been deposited during some volcanic eruption or a lava flow or a mud flow. And there's this, it's just quite amazing to be there. It's this just endless sea of boulders for miles and miles.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great place to do Mordor. Obviously the volcano is not quite that shape. This is more establishing the difficulty for Frodo.
The intention was to have much more of him, much more of the effort to cross the plains of Gorgoroth, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And the climb.
Yeah, well, I put in most of the stuff that we shot. Most of it's here, and this little scene leads up to them throwing away the armour. I wish we'd made a little bit more of Sam throwing the pots and pans away, because it's such a lovely moment in the book, and we have it here, but it's not. I just wish it was.
It was
one of those things that was just done as a hurry. I remember when this was shot, we were rushing to get scenes finished, and we were behind schedule, and we couldn't sort of dwell on it. But it needed that extra close up of Sam just saying goodbye to his trusty pots and pans, and we never had that.
Mr. Frodo.
I love that scene.
This is a little scene that Fran directed.
I didn't know that I was to do any directing at all, and I only found out when I saw my name on the call sheet. Peter had neglected to tell me. And then I was horrified because I didn't know what to do. We did shoot this scene twice. We had another run at it, but we shot this out on the Ruapehu Stony Plain with this big expanse of ground at the foot of one of our active volcanoes. It's an extraordinary landscape. It is not that, I hasten to add, that landscape is a model.
This is the New Zealand Army, who I think actually did a really good job. It's interesting because, as far as extras go, it's a very important fact that if you're going to have people portraying the Army, then the very best people to use are the Army. And they do bring reality to the fact that they're soldiers, which you wouldn't get from normal extras. This was shot the day after we did the scene at the beginning of the Two Towers, where they climb up and they talk about Lembas bread, and they sit down and take the Lembas bread out of their pack. Then the next day, in the same location, it was about 10 feet away from where we did that Two Towers scene, we did this bit for Return of the King. It was the first time that the guys had ever worn this makeup with all the parched lips and the cracked skin and things, and I really like it. We had to replace the sky in a lot of these scenes, because any time we were shooting Mordor, we had to have clouds in the sky because of the big cloud. And I remember a lot of the Mordor stuff was in blue skies and sun, so we had to have Weta do a major sky replacement for a lot of the Mordor scenes to get clouds there, which is sometimes not that easy, to pull a mat off the edge of people's hair and replace the sky above them, because sometimes the sky tends to burn out and you lose your edges around the hairline, and it gets a bit tricky. This was inspired by a scene in the book of Frodo swatting invisible flies walking along, which I always remember that passage and wanted to portray it in the movie. This particular scene is Sean Astin's last scene that we ever shot of him as Sam. It was his last day on Return of the King pickups. Finished the scene, and then we had a party for him straight afterwards. We did develop the eyeball in this film. It looks sort of the same, but we actually had it moving around, which I don't think we did in the earlier films, did we? We realised in this one that we had to have the eye actually physically searching for Frodo and Sam.
In the book, it's more internal.
It is.
And the eye is actually only seen by certain people, too.
Mm, and it's more powerful.
Mm.
But it's easier to write it than to show it, I think.
Yeah.
This location was interesting because it was actually, it's the only bit of wide, flat desert land in New Zealand that we could find, and it was near Ruapehu on the Army Munitions Training Ground. And this particular landscape had about 40 years of bombs dropped on it, hand grenades, mortars, bombs from aircraft, and this was a sort of a no-go area. It was an area that nobody ever goes because there's so much unexploded ammo there, and we said to the Army, listen, you've got to help us, this is the only place we can film, we need a flat desert landscape, and this is the only place in New Zealand we can find this landscape. The Army guys sort sort of rolled their heads looking like, oh my God. And I think if it was up to some of those junior officers, they would have told us just to get stuff. But fortunately, the government said to them, listen, you've got to help the Lord of the Rings people. So the army had to go through a bomb disposal exercise. They had to have their bomb disposal people clear decades worth of unexploded munitions. They had to clear it from this huge area. And on the day that we arrived to do the shooting here, we had a big lecture from the army officer who basically had it laid out on a table about 10 different types of bombs and hand grenades and said, listen, this is what you might find if you see any one of these objects lying on the ground. You're to stay still, put up your hand, and a bomb disposal person will come over straight away. And so we had bomb disposal people surrounding us while we were shooting, ready to jump in if any one of us kicked something with our toe and looked down and found it was a bomb on the ground. Quite a tense.
But didn't they say if you stray from the designated paths and you lose limbs, we're not responsible?
Well, no, it was all very strict and very kind of controlled, yeah. So The Mouth of Sauron is played by Bruce Spence. You'd certainly remember him if you'd seen Mad Max 2, which is The Road Warrior, I think it's called, and he plays the auto gyro, the little helicopter pilot. And he's along with Christopher Lee, and Brad Dourif, he's the other actor that actually was cut out completely out of Return of the King.
Yeah.
So it's great to have him back in again. And he's described as a Mouth of Sauron, and so I wanted Weta to design a helmet that just featured his mouth. And so they did something that deliberately sort of, it just didn't feature eyes. It was just, and the design of it was, everything was emphasizing the where the mouth was. And we shot Bruce and did the stuff, and he has a little prosthetic on around his lips. And then when we were in post, I just felt that the Mouth of Sauron wasn't distinctive enough, and it wasn't sort of memorable enough. And so what we ended up doing, which I think worked really well, and I'm really quite pleased with it, is we took Bruce Spence's original prosthetic mouth and we simply cut it out and we enlarged it and we pasted it back on again, so that the mouth that you're seeing here was exactly what we shot at the time, except about 50% bigger than his real mouth. And it's a disturbing effect because you don't quite know what's wrong with it, but it looks weird. It looks sort of unnatural.
And who is this? Isildur's heir. It takes more to make a king than a broken elvish man.
Another Aragorn beheading. It's great. Heads getting chopped off tends to pop up in these extended cuts. Something I'm quite grateful for, I have to say.
I do not believe it.
One of the main problems was that all the characters are engaging in the possible death of Frodo at a time that, because the film's back in chronological order, we know that Frodo's alive and well. And so suddenly your characters are playing things that we are not buying into. Because in the book, it's played in a way that you, the reader of the book, could possibly think that Frodo's dead at this stage. You actually are believing what the Mouth of Sauron's saying. And when we restructured the film to be more chronological, it just didn't work anymore in that way. We couldn't make it work anymore.
It's gone, Mr. Frodo.
This was a very small studio set surrounded by green screen. The rocks were made of a spongy sort of stuff. They looked like very sharp, jagged rocks. It would have been dangerous to have the actors falling on them and tumbling, so we made the rocks out of a sponge, and they were actually like soft rubber. Galloping back over the minefield again. That added a certain degree of tension to the days we were shooting here. And the army guys were looking at how far away they were galloping, and I think they were thinking, God, that they're going into a bit that we haven't cleared, because they were going a long way away, and I was getting a bit nervous about it. Viggo did the speech really well. He did it just as you see it. He did about 6 or 7 takes. He was shouting so much his voice was getting hoarser and hoarser as the takes were going through.
Is that a word, hoarser?
Well, it is now, possibly not before. And that's, again, that's the New Zealand Army that he's addressing. And it was good. It was a real sort of military moment, because Viggo was throwing himself into it and the soldiers were responding really well and appropriately. It's the sort of thing I guess soldiers expect to hear from some general, don't they?
I doubt their generals are that inspiring.
No, not the New Zealand Army, no.
Well, you don't know.
No, we don't know.
Hey, Gallipoli.
Gallipoli.
They all got killed in Gallipoli.
I know, but someone convinced him to do it.
This is more dangerous than it actually looks. I mean, I know it doesn't look that dangerous, but It was so dangerous that Sean and Elijah actually had safety wires on them when they were climbing up that bank. It was a lot steeper than it ended up looking on film, and we had to paint the wires out because you can see them trailing on behind them. It was on the side of a real volcano. This is my favourite bit of Howard Shaw music. The
beautiful
flute
that
he plays. I think this is probably, my favourite track of music.
The whistle?
Yeah, the whistle, rather. The whistle. It's beautiful.
He's a genius.
And I remember shooting this stuff. I remember this day. It was on the side of the volcano.
Yeah.
And we had big lights, and these are all real rocks, and this stuff isn't rubber. They were clambering up, and it was quite a steep slope, and yeah, it was kind of dramatic stuff to film.
I remember this day because this was the day you gave up smoking.
I did. I gave up for a year.
We had to stop writing to go to
the
pharmacy to get you some patches.
Are you smoking now?
Maybe.
Oh, God. That means you are.
Mm.
This stuff was an amalgam of original footage and some pickups we did. We shot like this little exchange between Legolas and Gimli during pickups separately because they weren't in the country at the same time. We shot Orlando first and then John Rhys-Davies later because we wanted to introduce a little bit more character stuff into this climax.
Saying goodbye to each other, isn't it? And also wrapping out their little story that was in there.
That's really sweet. And then this scene here, which is one of my favourite scenes personally. So this was shot in a hurry. It was done on the edge of a volcano, and it was done at the late afternoon. It was the same day that we'd shot all the crawling up stuff, and it was one of those situations where I hadn't planned the day too well because I'd spent like three quarters of the day shooting them crawling, shot after shot of them crawling, and then this long dialogue scene got squashed into the last two or three hours. Sometimes you sit out in the day and you don't quite judge it properly, and you end up realizing when it's too late that you've spent most of your time on the wrong thing. And I realised, oh God, I've got this incredibly important dialogue scene to shoot, and we were literally losing the light. The sun was going down fast. It was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon when we started. And so what we did is we just did it in two shots, because that's all we had time for. We started by shooting the close-ups of Sean and Elijah, and we shot them together. So we had one camera, our A camera on Elijah and our B camera on Sean, which you don't normally do. Normally you shoot one actor and then you turn the cameras around and you shoot the other actor separately, but I didn't have time for that. So I actually did what they call cross-coverage, where you're shooting them both simultaneously. And we did three takes is all that we had time for. And we literally couldn't do a fourth take because we were losing the light so fast. We had time to do one wide shot, which I also needed, and I did that with an A and B camera as well. So when it cuts to the wide shot of him picking him up and stuff, that's the other wider camera. And it was done as a rush, but they threw themselves into it, and Sean was amazing, Elijah was great, and what you see here is what we got in a hurry at the end of the day.
And that's Sean really picking up Elijah, yeah?
Yep, that's Sean and that's Elijah, and they did it for real, yeah.
Isn't that cool? Remember we sent that fax? We saw that we were back here, and we'd seen the rushes, and we sent the boys a fax, and we made it look really formal, like it was a memo. On the next page, we put, "You made us cry."
This is a very hybrid scene, and it's one of our dreaded scenes. It was based around the idea that Sauron is coming out to face Aragorn, and what you're seeing here of Aragorn walking towards the eye, Viggo was actually walking towards Sauron on the day that we shot it, you know, 4 years ago on the desert.
Towards Annatar.
Well, yeah, don't get... We're walking towards a vision which turns out to be Sauron.
We thought we wanted to have a showdown by the King of Gondor and Sauron, and we thought, well, he's just an eyeball, so it's going to have to be a kind of projected vision. And we also thought it would be interesting, because you didn't want the big 14-foot warrior to come out immediately, that you're waiting to see the most hideous being on the earth, an embodiment of evil, and in fact he's beautiful. So we had this conceit for a long time that we just threw out there, that actually Sauron would appear and he would be the most beautiful man you've ever seen, which is, of course, Annatar, the way in which he fooled the elves.
Sauron the Fair.
Yes, Sauron the Fair, yeah.
If for no other reason, it just felt like we'd got to the end of this film and we were back to the beginning of the first one, not coming up with anything new or different. It was the same imagery that when Sauron's bashing the hell out of...
Yeah.
Out of Isildur at the beginning.
In the beginning we were following storytelling rules, which have your showdown between your big hero and your villain.
Mm-hmm.
This sequence was a pickup that we did. We'd shot a version of the scene similar but not as good in our original shoot, and it was about the first time we ever filmed anything with Gollum, and we didn't really know what we were doing and how it was all going to work. And I realized when I looked at the footage that we did the first time round that the fight was just not going to be very good because we hadn't shot it properly. We hadn't quite done it in the way that we subsequently got much more experience at doing Gollum scenes. So.
This wasn't in the theatrical, was it? Smeagol lied.
No, the dialogue, some of the dialogue wasn't. And so we ended up just reshooting. I mean, we did write some new dialogue for it and changed it a bit, but it was basically redoing something that we had a crack at about 3 years earlier.
Yeah, and we wanted in that little moment, Smeagol promised, Smeagol lied, to show that actually everyone who'd been sucked in by how nice Smeagol was had misunderstood the true nature of his character. This was great cutting here, Pete.
Yeah, this was one of those situations where the editing is finally what's going to make the difference with these sorts of scenes, that you have any number of ways you can go. We just shot lots of fighting. You always shoot too much, and then you just pick out the very best little bits and pieces, and there's so many ways you could cut it together, and you have to figure out how long are you going to stay with the Black Gates battle before you go back to Frodo and Sam, and where are Frodo and Sam going to be, and it's just a range of possibilities.
And we got to use the moth again. Yay!
Yeah, no, well, I thought if we're going to bring the eagles in, we should bring the moth in to at least tie it back into the old fellowship imagery that we had. Because it is in the book, of course, that the eagles arrive at the end. It does make you wonder why they didn't summon an eagle at Rivendell and just have the eagle fly to Mordor.
The Nazgul would have taken them out.
Yes, I know, we've already discussed it, haven't we?
Everybody always says that, but...
When we were editing The Return of the King last year, I remember at one stage thinking, you know what, if I keep going in chronological order, I'm going to run out of time and the last, you know, half an hour of the film is going to get rushed. And I knew that the editing of this was going to be something that had to be felt right. So I jumped out of cutting earlier material and I just started to edit. And I said, if I'm going to spend any time on something in this film in the editing room, it's got to be these last climactic sequences. And if I'm rushing things at the end, I'd rather rush other stuff. So I jumped onto this and I spent a lot of time with Jamie Selkirk editing the sequence and really trying to make it work, and we tried two or three different things, and then eventually it just sort of clicked. We just got it, and it worked, and
it's really good.
And it never really changed.
What did you rush?
I can't remember now. I can't remember
all
the rest of it. Everything else. Crack of Doom was a tiny set. It was just a bit of stone wall, really, was just about all it was, with a little piece of rock, and most of the wide shots are a miniature, and we just put so much smoke and coloured light in there that we got away with it. It was actually, I'm quite pleased with the way that it ended up, considering how simple it was.
Who designed the Crack of Doom?
I actually feel it was mainly John Howe at the beginning. I think that was one of the things that we got John to do.
Crack of Doom is such a dodgy name now, but at the time it probably wasn't such a dodgy name.
Why is it dodgy?
Well, it just sounds like something out of Dungeons and Dragons or, you know, sort of B-grade fantasy, don't you think? Crack of Doom.
Sex industry.
Oh, God.
Hey, shush, shush, shush. This stuff's always hard to shoot. There's something freaky about shooting your climax, you know, because in one way or another, everything's leading up to it, and you just don't want it to be disappointing. And it's tricky for the actors, it's tricky for everybody. Sean and Elijah are always just committed to it so deeply. That's an image I always wanted to see, which was Gollum on top of the invisible Frodo's shoulders. I thought that would look really cool. Now, the interesting thing with this troll is that this is using the Sauron fight footage. We painted Sauron out and we put the troll in because we never shot anything of Aragorn fighting the troll. We shot a little bit of him at the end, actually, lying on the ground. But we decided that the best fight footage we could use was actually the original footage of him fighting Sauron. I didn't want to wimp out at showing the whole thing of Frodo's finger getting bitten off. I wanted that to be fairly graphic, just to be what it was, with lots of blood, because I thought at this stage in the movie you just can't afford to not go there, you know.
It's a great shot. I love that shot.
That's a shot that's only possible with computer, you see, because the ring is too small to obviously pass a film camera through, obviously, unless you have one of those cameras that they stick up your bottom. But we won't talk about that. But in a computer, you can actually just pass through a tiny object like a ring and... sorry, a laparoscopic camera passing through the ring. Well, yes, indeed.
You're the one who's lowering the tone of the conversation.
Andy was very determined to save a moment where Gollum stands on his 2 feet rather than all fours for this moment at the end. In fact, there was a couple of times earlier when I talked about Gollum lurching to his feet and he just refused. Andy said, no, we've got to do that in the Crack of Doom. We've got to save that. I think he was probably thinking, how can I show the ring empowering my character? He really wanted to make something of the fact that the ring and standing up like a normal human being was a way that Andy felt he could actually show the ring doing that.
Then we'd be the master. Mm. Yeah.
I never liked the idea of Gollum dancing with joy and then accidentally falling into the lava, which is basically what happens in the book. I just personally, I know why Tolkien did it and I know all the arguments for it, but I just never wanted to do that. I felt so strongly that Frodo had to be some part of it.
Yes.
We shot it three ways.
We did.
We shot the first time, we shot Frodo murdering him, basically just shoving him in.
Mm-hmm.
Then we shot the book, which was Gollum dancing around and foot tripping and falling in himself. And then we did this version, which was actually done right at the very end, wasn't it? It was done on just about Elijah's last day, I think.
Mm-hmm.
This is a shot that was the last shot that Weta delivered for the theatrical Return of the King. This was being worked on right up until it was too late, because it was a tough shot to do. How do you show this bloody ring finally being destroyed? Originally, this wasn't going to be the way it was cut. We were going to show the ring being destroyed, then we were going to show all of this saving sequence. We're going to have the two separated, but we ended up editing it, like cross-cutting it between the two events, to make it seem like it was all happening at the same time. Yeah, that was a late thought, wasn't it?
Looking at the whole sequence play out, it felt quite kind of bloated and extended. It felt like the climax of the film was dissipated over too great a period of time. And that was when we all talked about, well, you know, what if we collapsed it all into one moment?
Yes.
This was another kind of... It's one of those moments that you dread doing. And you actually dread it because you're just worried that it's not going to live up to expectations. And it was basically the destruction of Mordor. What happens when the ring gets destroyed? I mean, that's a big question. And it's not, you know, it's not described in great detail by Tolkien in the book. But what happens to all the orcs? I mean, do they all drop down dead when the ring's destroyed? Or, I mean, what happens? What happens?
No, they do talk about it.
To Sauron. You know, they sort of do a bit, but it's like... It's one of those things that's scary. It's just basically frightening to have to visualize it because you're worried that you're not going to do it justice. And we decided early on that the destruction of the Black Tower was going to be a digital model, not a model that we would blast apart with pyrotechnics, like often you see miniatures being destroyed with little explosions and film them with slow motion. And so we had one of our CG artists, Gray Horsfield, spent literally months and months building and designing the destruction of Barad-dûr, and he ultimately delivered the goods. He did a great job, but it was a very complicated job for him to do it in the computer. And then I wanted some really biblical size. I always regarded this as being, this is got to be biblical in its, not just its size and scale, but also in the way you portray the events. It's like the parting of the Red Sea, isn't it? It's just some apocalyptic vision. And I wanted it to have that scale because I think the film deserves it, or the three movies deserve it. You get to this point, you've earned the moment where you can get to see this finally happen, because you've been trying to get to this place and this moment in time for like, you know, 10 or 11 hours.
It's deliberate.
Now it is. The reactions were also difficult to do too. They were all done in pickups. We actually realized one of those things, because we thought that we'd shot the end of the Return of the King, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, in our original shoot. But when we came to edit this film together, we actually realized that one of the things we hadn't really shot was the reaction of everybody else to the destruction of the ring. We literally just hadn't done it, because I hadn't thought about it really. I think I'd shot Gandalf reacting, but nobody else. And so when each of our actors came out for pickups last year, they each had their turn, because they were in the country at different times. They weren't all together. So they each had their turn at reacting to the destruction of Mordor, and I'd put them in the costume and have a few extras behind them and explain what was going on. And so, you know, Viggo did it, Ian did it again, Orlando did it, Billy did it, Dom did it. They each had to do their bit, and I wanted their reactions to be obviously appropriate to their character and to be different from each other. So we just went through a variety of different performances. It's a hard thing to react to, because you're literally just staring at a piece of tape on the wall, and yet you've got to portray this cataclysmic emotional event. And I thought all of them did really well. You know, there wasn't a bum note in their house, as they say. The lava's all computer-generated. I think it's a combination, actually, computer-generated and sort of a milk and syrup mixture that they blast in the air.
Around the Ohio River.
This scene wasn't so difficult to shoot, really. These scenes are sometimes a bit easier, because I had a fairly clear idea in my mind about what I wanted this scene to feel like and to look like. Some scenes you know the moment you write them, or the moment you think about them, you know what you want them to be, and they're ultimately easy. So for, you know, a couple of years later, you find yourself on the set shooting and it's not so bad. Other scenes, like the destruction scenes or Frodo and with the ring and the Crack of Doom, you dread some of these scenes because you type them into the script. You talk about them, but you really don't quite know what they have to be or what they should be like. And you kind of dread the day when you have to shoot them, and you just hope that when you arrive on that day you've actually got a good idea, and sometimes you do and sometimes you don't. And usually the great thing I've discovered though is that if I don't have good ideas on the day, often the actors do, and sometimes you show up on set and you're just relying on the actors, you know, and if I don't have a good idea, I might just say, okay boys, well let's just block the scene and run it through and show me what you think, you know, and I sort of let them come up with something. This was another moment which I always imagined too, which was just this fade to black, because I wanted a real feeling that it might have been the end, and I wanted this long black patch, and then I just wanted this image. This was an image that was based or inspired by a painting that John Howe did. It was this moment, this exact moment, and I remember seeing the painting.
Yeah.
It was while we were in pre-production on the film. We hadn't shot anything yet, and that painting just gave me a sense of exactly what this moment should be. And then I wanted this too. I never had a problem with this. This is one of those sequences that I had ingrained in my mind about 2 or 3 years before we ever shot it. I sort of had this feeling of what I wanted to do with this fade to white and then to dissolve through the photo in the bed, you know.
It never changed.
This is another difficult scene for actors to play. I mean, you've got to imagine, you know, if you're one of our actors playing Frodo's friends, you know, the other members of the Fellowship, I mean, what do you do? What does your character do when they see Frodo alive? And I know, I remember that discussion with Ian. And I said to him, well, what would Gandalf do? And Ian thought, and he said, I think Gandalf would laugh. And so I said, okay, that sounds good. let's laugh then. And that's what he did.
And it's back where they were.
Yeah.
But also in the book it says that Gandalf's laughter talks about him laughing.
Yeah.
And his joy.
And then everybody, this was a little bit like everyone having to react to the destruction of the ring that we just talked about. You know, now they're having to react to Frodo. Seeing Frodo again, and so it's important moments for the characters. It's so important to get them all together again.
Some people hate this stuff. It's really interesting. There was such a strong reaction amongst people who had seen the film, and there was some people that for this, they sobbed at this moment.
Yeah.
And then other people absolutely hated it. Because I think it's fantastic.
Oh, well, it's horses for courses. But I think the characters deserve it. I mean, I know if I was watching the movie, I'd want to see this sort of scene. I mean, it's exactly what I'd want to see.
I've been in movie theatres, so many movie theatres now, where at that moment all you can hear is the sniffling. And it's like, it's working.
This is a great moment between these two, and I'm really very happy with this.
But we had a longer scene written, do you remember? We'd written a whole conversation, and I remember on the day, people turned up with those pages, and you threw it all out.
Probably threw it out, because we were running out of time. This was another image that I had from the beginning of this climb up the prow. Actually, I always imagined it with confetti streaming down. I always thought of it being like a rain of confetti sweeping past the camera as you rise up past the prow. And I think that's what was in our storyboards, but we never did that in the movie at the end of the day. Or petals, those little rose petals it was going to be, not confetti. But this was a combination of original stuff that we shot with the crowd stuff, was, and the wide shots were originally shot, but we did pickups of the close-ups of Gandalf and Aragorn, basically, where they were reshot.
Now come the days of the king.
And that earlier shot of Gandalf when he says, "Now come the days of the king, may they be blessed." That was his last shot on
that
the film.
That was Ian's last shot ever as Gandalf, yeah. Yeah, that was it was his last day. It's interesting, you remember all those last shots, don't you?
Well, I actually missed it, but yeah. I remember thinking
being told about it.
No, I was on the mocap stage with Andy, and we rapped late,
oh,
and you
right.
rapped before us.
That's right.
I tried to get
down
there.
That's right. In the original shoot, Viggo had a fake beard on because it was done at the time he was doing everything else in the film. He obviously didn't have a beard, so it was fake. But when he came out to New Zealand to do pickups, we said to him, "Listen, can you grow a beard and we'll reshoot all the close-ups of you with a real beard?" Because the beard looked kind of fake. And that was one of the reasons that we wanted to reshoot the close-ups, actually. And so he grew this beard. It was the first thing that we shot, and then we had him shave it off and do the rest of his Aragorn stuff. It was Viggo's idea to sing the song, which is in the book, isn't it, that Aragorn sings?
No, he just says in Elvis that the...
Okay. He said no.
No.
Oh.
But, I mean, it's great.
It's interesting. It's a sort of, it's one of those things that could work or might not work.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just think it's unexpected. I mean, to have him turn around and... then to start singing is unusual, it's unexpected, it feels like Tolkien, and so therefore I think it's a good thing to do.
It is Tolkien.
I think just the mere fact that it's a surprise alone makes it sort of interesting, and then I just think it's nice for his character. This is a lovely moment for Liv. Another one of those major events, something we've been waiting for 3 movies, to get these two finally together. And just figuring out how to shoot this stuff is kind of tricky, because often shooting it just in a simple, elegant way is better than making it overly complex. When we redid this, some of the stuff in pickups, it was primarily for the beard, really, because the fake beard did look fake. And we changed the staging of it a wee bit, didn't we?
We wanted Elrond to be there with Arwen.
That's right, because in the original shooting, Elrond wasn't in her. She was in separate shots with an incredibly unusual hairstyle. Which we didn't like.
Yeah.
Elrond's hairstyle was very, very unusual.
He looked like my favourite Martian.
Oh, what a shocker.
We had Elrond's hairstyle that we didn't like. We had Viggo's fake beard that we didn't like. And then I wanted them to have a real good kiss, which we didn't have in the original shooting either, did we? I wanted them to I just felt like they needed to just, you know, because it was one of those, it's a bit like what we were saying with Gandalf, is what do you do when you see Frodo's alive? Well, you laugh. And what would these two do when they come together? And you think, well, of course, what would they do? They'd grab each other and have a hell of a great kiss, you know. And we just felt that's the most obvious thing to do. And it also just breaks that formality, you know, all the pompous ceremony that's been going on. Just get them together. this moment here is probably my favourite moment out of the entire trilogy, I would say.
You bow to no one.
This is a moment when there's always a huge sniffle in the audience with the film screen, and it's usually me. It's interesting with the ending, because this whole sequence has copped, I guess, the most criticism of Return of the King. I wonder whether some of the criticism was due to the bladder factor, and I think a lot of people, they were getting to this point, they were just wanting the film to end so they could rush out to the toilet. So the fact that there was scene after scene after scene for another 20 minutes, that possibly accentuated the sort of the whole multiple ending thing for some people. Now, this is interesting, this stuff here, because we actually shot little epilogue bits for the other characters that we never used, and I'm not using it in the extended cut either because it just doesn't really need it. But we did a little bit of showing what happened to Legolas, to Gimli, to Faramir and Eowyn.
You didn't use any of it?
No, because I just didn't. I thought the film played fine. The scenes that have gone in and the scenes that I just thought would be fun to have in, and fun is actually the word, not because they need to be in to make the film better, not because they putting them in sometimes can make the film worse. But those are not the reasons why. The reasons why is that I think they're just fun to have in, and you know, the scenes that I don't think are particularly fun to put in, I don't put in. You know, it's just, that's actually fun is kind of the best way to describe it. I don't make any decisions any deeper than that, really. This scene in the pub here is actually one that we shot in pickups. That all of the rest of this last 20 minutes is most of it's original footage that we did in our principal photography. But this one sequence here, we didn't have. Oh, and Sam's wedding too, we didn't have those two sequences. But this was important to me because I felt that it actually was what Tolkien had in mind, and I wanted to dramatize it because he had been a soldier in the First World War. And one of the things that just about all veterans of the First World War talk about is a sense of coming home to their families and their village where they left from. And they've been thoroughly changed by the experience. They've gone through horrors that they could never describe, and they literally couldn't talk to anyone about it, so therefore nobody understood. And the only people that understood were those other friends that had been to war. And I wanted that feeling amongst those four guys, that they were there, but no one else knew how heroic they really were, and they didn't expect to be treated like heroes either. And I thought that was very true to what Tolkien would have experienced coming back from the First World War himself. And then we didn't have Sam's wedding originally shot either, and we thought that this was a pickup that we should do, it was worth doing.
Just to go back to your point about the multiple endings, I think that we should bear some responsibility for that in terms of the storytelling. Ultimately, if the point is about the destruction of Frodo, then the audience should be given that expectation, that they will know then that there is more to come, but we never actually made that point. And if we had, you know, had a bit more time, dare I say, to shape the story, we could have, we probably would have got there in the end, you know.
We would have got there.
We'd have found a way to do that, but we ran out of time to shape the end in the way that I think we probably could have alleviated some of that stuff.
We were aware of it. I remember I had a line in there that was Frodo and Theo going, Bilbo always told me that the great stories never end. And Fran was saying,
I wouldn't let him use it.
You wouldn't let us put it in there. Because she was terrified that it would point out the fact that the story's never ending.
It's too much a comment on the film itself.
That have taken hold.
The backshot of Frodo is referencing the backshot on Bilbo.
It was a sort of an interesting scene because we really wanted to start to have the effects of this journey. Because this is some 2 or 3 years after they've gotten home, isn't it? And We did makeup on Elijah, just make him seem pale and gaunt, like the colours never quite come back into his cheeks. And we wanted him to feel very, I mean, depressed is not quite the right word, but the way that we shot the scene was with colours that were sort of muted. Everything was in shades of brown. There wasn't any bright colours in the set. We made sure the costumes weren't bright. We did a lot of just subtle things to try to make it, the whole atmosphere seem...
He's sick, and he knows he's not getting any. He's not going to get better.
No.
I think we sort of failed to communicate that quite clearly enough.
I know, because there was a thought latent coming to us yet again.
Mm.
But never mind, we got there in the end.
There and back again. A Hobbit's Tale by Bilbo Baggins. And The Lord of the Rings by Frodo Baggins. You finished it.
Is that Elijah's last shot, Pete?
The line that he was saying to Sam was the very last shot. In fact, the bit at the end when he says there's room for a little more was the very last moment.
Bilbo once told me.
We had Elijah recording a lot more voiceover, but it just felt too much talking. Mm. I can't even remember now what we ended up using. Not a great deal, because a lot of this just played better with music. And
no, we used some.
Yeah, we used like a fraction of what we ended up what we actually originally wrote and recorded.
Yeah.
Where are we going? To the harbour.
These were second unit shots done in Mahamana on the same farm as where Hobbiton was built. It was just around the corner from Hobbiton, actually. And this was shot a long time ago. It's a long, long time ago when Ian Holm was out in New Zealand doing the stuff for Fellowship of the Ring. Because Bilbo didn't appear in the Two Towers at all, and he was just in this last sequence and Return of the King, but it's a much older Bilbo. And so Richard Taylor did this prosthetic makeup and Gino. And I know that Ian Holm was really taken with the makeup. He loved standing in front of the mirror and looking at it and playing with it, and I think he was very impressed with it. It's very nice. It's old men makeup is a difficult thing to do, and I think this works pretty well. Grey Havens is another one of those places that hasn't really been illustrated a great deal. There's a couple of nice paintings that have been done with it, but we let Alan Lee go crazy on it. And I remember actually we were shooting in Hobbiton, the actual village of Hobbiton, when Alan came on set one day in a windy field and was showing me his first drawings of the Grey Havens. And the very first drawing that Alan ever showed me, I just said, yep, that's perfect, that's exactly what we want to do. And we never changed it, actually. We never changed the concept from that very first sketch of this incredible harbour with these buildings up the sides of the harbour and towers. And it was very elvish. Because I've never quite imagined what the Grey Havens looks like.
No. And I think we never really got across... I know some people did not understand that this is meant to represent death. Or at least in our minds, whether or not that's what Professor Tolkien was signifying. It's what we wanted it to be. And the fact that if you're mortal and you get on that boat, it's basically saying that you are dying. And that's in fact what Frodo's doing. A lot of people pick up on it, but some people don't.
Well, equally so, he's spiritually not going to death.
No, exactly. He's going to the other place. But he's not coming back.
All of Cate Blanchett's scenes were shot at the same time when she came out. She was only in New Zealand for about 2 weeks, and she shot all of her scenes for The Fellowship of the Ring, and then all of her little bits and pieces appearing in The Two Towers and Return of the King were all shot at the same time. And we needed Cate to be here at the Grey Havens, but it wasn't when we were shooting the scene with the rest of the guys, so we shot her all by herself against blue screen, doing her little moments, and that was shot with her several months before we did the rest of the scene with everybody else. So we didn't even quite know what the scene was going to be like when we shot her shots.
Not sad or not weep.
Did Gandalf always have his ring on? That's only recently turned up, hasn't it?
Yeah. This is just solely for the Tolkien fans. It's one for them, and they will understand the meaning of it, because we never really got into what the power of the three rings were, or in fact who the three ring bearers of the Elven rings were. But they are in fact Elrond, Galadriel, as she shows Frodo in Fellowship, and Gandalf. And you'll see here that he is wearing Narya, the Ring of Fire.
Yeah.
We set out to save the Shire, Sam.
This was a rather torturous scene to shoot, and I don't mean that in the sense of it being emotional, because that was okay, and the guys were doing an amazing job, but we shot the scene in one day. Very, very difficult, very emotional, lots of tears, because, you know, they're not pretending. They're doing this stuff for real to get themselves worked up into the emotion, and we looked at it the following day, and most of the footage was out of focus. It was actually one of the most disastrous days shooting that we ever did, particularly because of what it was. It was like we could not believe it. It was out of focus, most of the footage. And we actually, I had to break the news to the guys. I remember walking on set and saying, you know that Grey Haven stuff? Yeah, yeah. Well, I had a look at the dailies last night. Oh, yeah, yeah. And it was all out of focus. And I remember them looking at me, and I remember them saying, you're joking, right? You're kidding. This is not serious. And I had to say, yeah, and we're going to have to reshoot it. And we actually had to go back and film it again. And, you know, it's one of those weird things where you never quite know whether it was as good the second time round. I mean, I think it was, and I certainly think they're doing an amazing job here. But, you know.
I have to say that it wasn't Colin Dean, our wonderful focus puller.
No, it was another focus puller.
Bugger the scene up.
No,
it was,
it's somebody else. Yeah.
Well, Colin had gone to Australia, and shortly thereafter we begged him to return.
I love that moment where Frodo kisses Sam. It's from the book, and I just think it's beautiful.
Yeah, it's very beautiful.
I love this whole scene. You know what I always remember too, when you talk about multiple endings, and I think people have to understand that this, we're not ending one film, as you said, Pete. We're ending three, and this scene in particular is doing that.
But you're just watching one. That's the problem.
It's not a problem. Anybody who doesn't engage in that scene, and, you know, the vast majority do, people who were never going to engage in these movies,
I think that's exactly right. I think some people like certain types of films and other people don't, and you know, no one's going to buy into any of this stuff if they fundamentally don't like Lord of the Rings.
No. I remember seeing it for the very first time in that rough assembly, and seeing it with the guys, seeing it with Elijah and Billy and Dom and you, and it was phenomenal. It worked.
But I think for the uninitiated, for members of the audience who aren't familiar with the book, they really are in the dark here. When does this movie end exactly? I would have no idea.
See, I don't agree, and I've had a lot of comments to the opposite.
Because films are fairly formulaic, and you have the gigantic climactic sequence, and you have a small wrap-out kind of coda, which maybe...
There's only really one way of knowing...
20 minutes later, we're still here.
The only one way of knowing who's really right, and that's a Jell-O wrestle, where everybody that likes the endings goes on one side, and everybody that doesn't goes on the other, and they just wrestle it out in a big pit of Jell-O, and the ones that are left standing at the end are right, and that's the only way to really figure it out.
True. I think he's right.
And this is Ellie Aston. This is Sean's daughter. I've worked with Sean's dad, John Aston, and Sean and now Ellie, so I've worked with three generations of Astons. This is kind of interesting. And I remember this day in particular, another one of those little memories. I was standing here with Sean as we were shooting this scene, and I said to him, because this was January 2000, and I remember saying to him, you know what, Sean, the scene that we're shooting at the moment, it's going to be nearly 4 years before anybody sees this. And we looked at each other, and it just seemed like an incredible thought at the time. And, you know, it's amazing. It's amazing to me now that 4 years has gone by, and I'm looking at this, and I remember that comment.
And that's Sarah's McLeod's baby. Yeah.
Right. Oh, that was Sarah's baby as well. Yeah, of course it was. So, Sean and Sarah both had their kids there. Yeah. And I always had that in mind for the image. Right from our original storyboards, I always wanted to end on The Hobbit.
We wanted to end on the line while I'm back.
Yeah, that was obviously important.
That at least after everything we'd done, we ended up on the same page at the very end.
After all of the crimes committed against the book.
That's right.
We honoured the last line.
Mm.
And I like what we did with the credits here too, because the first two movies, we never said the end. We just had the credits beginning, and we kept the credits just very basic, which were just white letters on black background. And then because this is truly the last credits, these are the genuine final credits, I wanted them to feel like they're the end of the three films, so that you could chop the credits off the first two almost and join it all together, and these would become the final credits. So I wanted them to look and feel different. This is why we had Alan Lee do sketches. Alan didn't actually do many sketches for this. We just looked in his notebook, because he kept these amazing sketch pads or notebooks all the way through the 6 years he's worked on the films, and we went through and raided a lot of his little sketches and doodles to be in the background of these shots. And then we had Alan sketch the actors' faces, though. They were special sketches that he did just for this credit roll. I just wanted to do something that, and I loved the idea. It was actually something that I was talking about once with Ian McKellen, and we were talking about how in the old movies, it was a particular fad in the 60s, from memory, where you would sometimes have credits where there'd be little shots of actors when their names come up, and sometimes they sort of wouldn't smile or acknowledge the camera and do a little nod of the head.
And this is, in fact, a blend of photography and sketching, this
thing. Yeah, we picked stills of the actors, and then we had Alan sketch on them, and then we sort of did a half mixture. They're not pure sketches you're seeing, they're sketches with a little mix of actors' skin tones and flesh tones, just very subtly underneath.
The song is fantastic. I love the song. I remember when we were having a meeting about who was going to do the vocals for the end song, and actually we hadn't decided whether it was going to be male or female, but then we decided that who was it? The question was, who was the voice of this final song going to be? And we decided it was going to be Galadriel, really, and that led you back to a very, very early thought you had had a long time ago, one of your favourite singers, Annie Lennox, whose mm-hmm. voice you've always loved. And it was, when you said it, it was so right. It was one of those thoughts that was so right that everybody in the room got it and understood it. And thank God she said yes. She did a phenomenal job.
Yeah, she was a really great person to work with. And you never know, really, when you don't have any personal experience of someone, how it's going to be.
Yeah.
But it just turned
collaboratively,
out to be,
yeah,
really good.
No, I mean, Howard hadn't worked with her or even met her, had he?
No, well, he did obviously meet with her afterwards,
but beforehand it was just this instinct. It was pure instinct that she would be the right person, and she so was.
Into the West was a song that was actually inspired by a young man called Cameron Duncan.
Going into our last year of shooting pickups to complete The Return of the King, we met Cameron, who's a young New Zealand filmmaker. He was 16 years old at the time, and he was a very gifted filmmaker.
He was amazing. I mean, he was one of those, you know, you see a lot of work from young filmmakers, and this kid was the real thing. It was like stunning, actually, just how clever he was. Frightening.
Yeah.
At that age. Yeah.
And he came and spent time with us on set when we were shooting the pickups, and it was a great thrill for him to watch everything happening.
Yeah, yeah.
But Cameron had cancer the year before, and during early in 2003, he had a diagnosis of secondary relapse. He had metastases were found in his lungs, and so it was throughout that year he also underwent various forms of chemotherapy, and so his time with us was limited because it would be in between treatments. He'd be going away overseas to receive treatments, and he was getting sicker. And when we were in England in August and writing, we were thinking about writing the song, Cameron was very much
with us, and certainly in spirit. He was actually getting chemo at that time in New Zealand. But he was calling us and emailing us.
And he was making a little film.
He was making a short film, yeah. Which is called Strike Zone, which is a great testament to him. Yeah. And his abilities as a filmmaker and just who he is as a person. And it was during that time that it became more apparent to me that he wasn't probably going to beat this thing, even though that wasn't something that you let yourself think about. It felt like he probably wasn't going to beat the cancer. And so it was odd, because the song is very much about, you know, Frodo's passing, but it personally, for me, was also about reconciling the conflicted feelings about Cameron and what he was facing. And
I remember you were struggling with the song, because you were having to write this with Annie, and it was one job on top of everything else that you were doing with the film at the time. You were doing ADR, you were helping me with the edit, trying to fix the problems of the film, and you had these lyrics to write, and you were struggling. And I remember it was only when you sort of made a conscious decision to write the song about Cameron that it suddenly just went click, didn't it?
Yeah.
It was that sort of moment when you decided it was about something.
Yeah.
That you cared about.
Yeah. 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 And it...
Somebody.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and Cameron, in fact, Philippa and I, on the day that we were done with editing the film, it was in November of 2003, Philippa and I went out. We were shopping, and Cameron at that point, he had gone to Houston, to a hospital in Houston, to have an experimental chemo to try and beat these fast-growing tumours in his lungs. And we got home from our first day out.
We'd been playing the song, and we were talking about what next, and what if this doesn't work, this treatment doesn't work. And we'd driven home from Eastbourne the whole way, and I put the song on because I'd fallen in love with it, and we were playing it, but we were feeling like, well, there's maybe this, and he can look at doing this. And anyway, we got home.
We got home, and Pete was home in the middle of the day, which was very unusual to find him there. And he told us that Cameron had died a few hours earlier, and it was odd, because it was terribly shocking to me, even though I knew that I should expect it. It was incredibly shocking, and it was, it kind of came right at the end of the film. It was like two things coming together. It was a great shame he never saw it, in fact, because...
No, it's the one
I know.
Thing
he loved
he would
it.
Have loved to have seen the film.
And his body was brought back weirdly, on the Air New Zealand plane that had Frodo painted on the side, which
he would have loved.
His family brought him back, Sharon and Reese and Taryn and Chanel brought him
back. Into the West had its first public performance at his funeral. I mean, that was the first time that anybody had ever heard the song outside of us, was we played it at his funeral.
Yeah.
So that, you know, the song has a connection for us with Cameron that is very profound.
Yeah. We did.
He was our Frodo.
It's something, he was a special kid, that's all I can say. He really was. I know all kids are special, but he was extra special. And a lot of people felt it.
We should say...
What?
To the fans out there, thank you. The ones, especially the ones who have bothered to listen to us raving on.
The ones that haven't gone to the toilet.
And the ones that haven't gone to the toilet. Can we say thank you to them, because... you did, in the end, you did inspire us, and you did keep us on our toes. And
yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that. I mean, yeah.
You were a big part of this movie.
Yeah, completely. I mean, it's interesting how fans can influence you. And, you know, you get a lot of letters with people's ideas, you know, why don't you do this, why don't you do that? And that's not really how fans influence you. But what it is it's the realization that there's such an expectation out there that you become terrified of letting the fans down. And it's the fear factor, which is actually a valuable thing, because I think fear is a great motivating force. And you realize you have a responsibility to people who care so much about this book not to let them down. And I've really appreciated that. I've actually appreciated all of the fans, their enjoyment of these films and the sense of responsibility that's given us to have to deliver them the best possible film we can make, because that forces us to go above where we might naturally have stopped in our standards. But we go further because there's other people that care so much about this, not just us.
Yeah.
And that's actually a really valuable thing, and I feel so grateful. I think it has had a significant impact on shaping these films.
Yeah.
Well, Philippa said it twice today, a bit like Frodo on the Rock. It's over. It's done.
Well, it never will, in actual fact. I mean, that's the reality of this, is that the concept of it being done is only just very minor in the sense of our own work. You know, okay, we don't have to go in and mix a film anymore. We don't have to look at visual effects shots anymore. But, man, this is never done. This is going to be part of our lives till the day we die. I mean, that's the reality of it, is now that this is something that's so big that you can't walk away from it. So the concept, like a normal movie, and we've done it in the past with other films, where you can say, okay, that film's finished, we're moving on to our next film, and you literally, the other films do fade away eventually, you know, especially some of the early films we made, and you literally, you know, hardly ever hear of them again. But this one isn't going to be like that. This one is going to be their big front and center forevermore.
Absolutely. Mm. So you're going to lose the footage where you push in through the door and you go through and you follow Sam?
Oh, they got lost on last Friday.
Did it?
Because
that's amazing stuff. I thought that actually really was the end of the film. I think that when we lost that footage, we really lost the true wrap out on the film.
I know, but I did like meeting all the, you know, the other kids as well.
The kids were incredible.
And
Mary and Pippin.
Frodo grown up.
I know, that was amazing. That's great, that stuff.
I miss seeing the scene that we shot where Sam goes to the post office to check his mail the following day, and the scene where he takes his dog to the vet was also a great one. So we just need to let these people get to bed, and we've got to go looking for this lost footage. I'm a bit disturbed about that.
I know, you've lost a lot of it.
Yeah.
How much do you think that lost footage is valued at?
I don't know. Well, we've lost a lot today, I bet. We better go looking.
Okay.
So thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.